about Canada's historic and present relationship with the Organization of American States and foreign policy in South and Central America. Donald Kingsbury teaches political science and Latin American studies at the University of Toronto. His work centers on extractivism, decarbonization, and social movements in the Americas. Here are Kingsbury and Martin in conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Don. I guess to just get started here, Canada in Latin America, you know, Central and South America, their role doesn't seem to be something a big focus. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Canada's involvement in foreign policy in the area?
Yeah, Canada has, you might call a kind of on-again, off-again relationship and a very sectorally specific relationship with Latin America. For quite a long time, Canada was essentially a non-actor throughout the region, whether we're talking the Caribbean, Central America, or South America, in many cases not opening up functioning embassies until the mid-20th century. And indeed, the precursor to the Organization of American States actually explicitly barred Canada from entry for quite a long time. And the logic here was that Canada wasn't a fully independent republic. It was essentially a vassal of the United Kingdom, and therefore seen as having competing interests than the big player in the region, which has been the United States. So Canada really plays kind of a non-existent role until somewhere around the 1970s during the first Trudeau administration. And Trudeau, he's essentially the first Western leader to cross the U.S. blockade of Cuba. And he has, by all accounts, sincerely warm relations with Fidel Castro. Castro is actually a pallbearer at Trudeau's funeral in 2000. And the logic, this is part of a larger press that Canada is doing at the time to try to open up Latin American markets for Canadian goods. And that's a really different moment in the world economy where Canada is trying to sell stuff to the rest of the world rather than mine stuff out of it. When speaking of mining, that really brings us to where we are today, where essentially for the 21st century, Canada has been in the Americas operating essentially as an appendage of extractive industries, really working to both negotiate and smooth the way for Canadian mining firms, both major mining firms like Barrick Gold, which has a market cap in the tens of billions of dollars, or these kind of smaller junior miners that are essentially a geologist, a drill, and a website, whose entire business plan is to get gobbled up by one of the bigger companies. All of these formations work through Canadian embassies and consulates in order to create ties with local governments. And in some cases, notoriously, especially during the Harper administration, Canada would actually pick up the tab, for, you know, environmental spills, human rights violations, and other financial aftermaths of Canadian extraction in the region. And so it goes from not really a player in the region to its kind of preferred image as middle power, independent, but at the side of the United States during the first Trudeau era, and then into what we have now, which is really a promoter for extractive industries.
So you talked a bit about the Organization of American States, the precursor to that. For our listeners who may not know exactly what that organization is and what it does, can you give just a brief background of how it came to be formed, why it kind of came to heads with Canada in this Cuban foreign policy?
The Organization of American States is formed in the immediate aftermath of World War II. Its founding meeting is in 1948. And from the get-go, it's really kind of a hemispheric Cold War body for multilateralism with a pretty heavy asterisk there, meaning it's a multilateralism that's really guided by United States policy and United States designs for the region. Famously, in 1954, in Caracas, Venezuela, there's a declaration by heads of state and diplomats or ambassadors to the Organization of American States, which explicitly declares communism to be a foreign doctrine with no place in the United States. Keep in mind, you know, the Cold War really, really kicks off in 1949. You know, we've got the end of World War II and Reconstruction happening in Europe. The Soviets test their first nuclear weapons successfully in 49. The People's Republic of China is declared by Mao and his rebels in 1949. And it's really a moment of dividing up the globe, geopolitically speaking. And the Organization of American States is really the vector driving U.S. designs in the region. And I hasten to add that it's not just the United States pulling puppet strings. There are, of course, elites in business, in government, and in the military of Latin American countries that are very willing collaborators. But that's really the role of the Organization of American States. Throughout the Cold War, You know, for example, you know, Cuba is expelled shortly after the nationalization of U.S. assets on that island after the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And the OAS expels it as a, you know, a communist state with, you know, ties to the Soviet Union. Interestingly, though, the OAS is largely silent on the human rights abuses that take place during the civil wars in Central America throughout the 1980s in places like Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And so you really have a kind of two-faced or inconsistent view on human rights and democracy in the Americas that's expressed by the OAS. Canada, interestingly, circling back to Canada here, Canada doesn't join the OAS until 1990. And part of that is because of this lingering kind of Anglophilia or Anglophobia, I guess you could say, you know, the United States not really trusting Canada, even though, you know, very tight cultural, trading, political ties between the two countries historically. But Canada joins the OAS in 1990 as part of a kind of larger overhaul of Canada's self-perception in the Americas and a shift in Canadian foreign policy. You know, these are moments when Canada is signing free trade agreements with the United States. Negotiations for NAFTA between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico are taking place. It's also a moment in which Canada is really trying to resolve crises within its borders that have to do with the kind of industrial compromise between workers and capital, some major, shall we say, protests and dissent around the impacts of mining in Canada by Canadian mining companies. The Quebec question is huge. Questions that we'll eventually start talking about in terms of reconciliation between First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people and the government of Canada. All of these are really percolating in the 1980s at the time that the globe itself, the global economy, is shifting towards what we now call the neoliberal era, right? Emphasis on quote-unquote free markets, emphasis on foreign direct investment, privatization, deregulation. And Canada, in this moment in the 1990s, after it joins the OAS, is really shifting itself at that time as well. And so that's just a real kind of quick potted history of the OAS and then Canada's initial steps into that organization.
I think that's a good overview. And what I've seen, at least in my research, is that since joining in 1990, participation directly in that organization has been hit or miss. But it's interesting that you mentioned like Caracas and Venezuela being such a crucial part of the beginning of the OAS, because you've written quite a bit about Canada and the Lima Group and Venezuela. So could you tell us a little bit about that dynamic?
Sure. And you know, to be clear, 1954, Venezuela is very different from Venezuela in the 21st century. In 1954, actually, you know, Venezuela is being ruled by a, you know, extreme anti-communist military dictatorship under Marcos Perez Jimenez. Whereas when we get into the 21st century, after the election of Hugo Chavez in 1999, Venezuela really starts charting a very independent, very anti-imperialist, well, socialism for the 21st century is the slogan. Canada has always been, at best, lukewarm vis-a-vis Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution. It has either very nervously tried to guard the assets of Canadian mining companies and oil contracting services providers in that country, or more recently, really put its, you know, kind of political diplomatic capital behind efforts to really try to push for a soft coup. And that's where we get to the Lima Group. You know, of course, Hugo Chavez dies in 2013, and Venezuela has been in a political, economic, and social crisis ever since. His successor, Nicolas Maduro, doesn't have the kind of political will, vision, or capacity that his predecessor has. And Canada has really been at the forefront of diplomatic efforts to oust him. I want to just like put aside any debate about the merits of the Maduro government, have that conversation another time. I'm not a fan, but I'm also not a fan of efforts to force regime change from abroad. The Lima Group is kind of the U.S. light. You know, of course, the United States has been implicated in attempts to overthrow governments in Venezuela throughout the 21st century, most notably in that failed coup d'etat against Chavez in 2002, and then also its support for an oil bosses lockout in 2003. And during this time, these early moments, you know, Canada's really just kind of sitting aside, not really doing anything. This shifts when we get closer to the present moment. 2019, for example, Canada recognizes the self-declared presidency of Juan Guaido, a member of the president at the time of the National Assembly, who declared himself, he didn't even put his hand on a Bible, right? Like, says, I'm now president of Venezuela, and all of the Western powers, you know, dutifully just, you know, say, yes, you are, including in cases in the United States, Canada, and the UK of seizing Venezuelan sovereign assets and putting them at the control of this, you know, essentially self-declared government in absentia. 2017, you had mentioned the Lima Group. 2017 is the kind of formation of the Lima Group. Latin America looks very different in 2017 than it does today. And the Trudeau government, it should be noted, in Canada is you know, kind of in its early stages, still trying to find its kind of signature issues. It really hasn't found something to kind of latch the Canadian flag onto like it has with the war in Ukraine. So 2017, at a meeting of the Summit of the Americas, Canada aligns with basically the entire right of center bloc of Latin American heads of state at the time. So shoulder to shoulder with people like, at the time, Michel Temer, but later Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Sebastián Piñera in Chile, Iván Duque in Colombia, and so forth and so on. Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico. Point being that the Trudeau administration, which is, you know, very happy to present itself as a kind of sunny ways antidote to the Harper years, lines up shoulder to shoulder with governments that are well noted for attacks on people's democratic rights, for abuse, including, you know, detention and assassination of land and water protectors, notorious homophobes, and the list goes on and on. The purpose of the Lima Group is to try to pressure a regime change in Venezuela. And it's very explicit about that. It also does this very explicitly without allowing the United States to join. Now, the logic here is that since the United States has such a bad track record with Venezuela, doesn't have any sense of impartiality, right? It doesn't have any, and it's not seen as a neutral actor. Whereas Canada, self-declared neutral power that had stood independent, had a very independent stance from the United States despite its, you know, economic integration. So it has a bit of credibility, diplomatically speaking, and it throws all this into regime change in Venezuela. And so this takes the form of recognizing the self-declared Guaido government, and also the form of inviting and really feeding prominent figures from the Venezuelan opposition in Canada at places like the University of Toronto, in Parliament, in Ottawa, and so forth. And I should also add, not just members of the opposition, figures of the hardest, most extreme members of the opposition who are calling not just for elections, internationally monitored elections, but for regime change, people who have advocated for military intervention in Venezuela, people who have been most outspoken in the need to essentially have a purge within Venezuela after regime change happens, you know, shrinking of the state and even trials for members of the Bolivarian government. And so again, this is Canada who pulls up just short of supporting armed intervention, military intervention in Venezuela, but has been perfectly willing to try to support regime change by other means. Now, of course, since 2019, the political map has shifted in Latin America again, and all of Trudeau and Friedland's allies in the region are no longer in office. And you have people like Lula back in office in Brazil, Gustavo Petro in Colombia, Gabriel Boric in Chile, who have their criticisms of the government in Venezuela, but who have been very insistent that any resolution to the crisis in Venezuela is going to have to come from Venezuela, not from the Lima Group, not from the United States, and certainly not from Canada.
I think that's really important context for understanding Canadian foreign policy in Latin America, obviously, but also how the OAS fits into this. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you about this is because a former ambassador to Haiti from Canada is now being appointed to the OAS. His name's Stuart Savage. So what does this relationship between the OAS as an organization and, of course, Canada has quite a notorious history in Haiti. What does that mean for the future of approaching, you know, policy in action in Latin America from Canada?
It certainly doesn't suggest that Canada will be a pull for independent positions, human rights stances, principled stances for human rights or even, you know, democracy in the region. It's the situation in Haiti is of course complex, and I know Rabl has talked to people with much more direct personal history in Haiti. What I can say though from where I'm sitting is Canada certainly hasn't helped the endemic instability that has characterized Haiti for most of our lives and even before. And these are elements of malice, and sometimes these are elements of ineptitude. The kind of flip-flopping on supporting the Martelly government, for example, a government that was widely criticized for corruption, for human rights abuses, for breaking diplomatic principles. One day Canada supports them, the next day Canada doesn't. And, you know, Canada has, you know, not quite as bad of a track record in terms of quote-unquote humanitarian assistance in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake that, for example, Brazil has come under heavy criticism for, you know, reintroducing diseases that had been eradicated in Haiti, cholera outbreaks, things like this. You know, Canada is not, doesn't quite have that bad of a reputation, but it certainly has not contributed to the immediate, medium, or much less long-term stability of Haiti. You know, a country at this point that doesn't have a civilian government and is under blockade because of essentially internal conditions of ungovernability that Canada and the rest of the West have done, you know, everything in their power, either through ineptitude or malice, to maintain in that country. So naming a Canadian ambassador to Haiti to the OAS doesn't really suggest that Canada is going to, you know, play a more independent, more humanitarian, more democratic role in the OAS, even if that were possible in an organization like the OAS, which is questionable at best.
In one of your pieces on the Lima Group in 2019, you brought up an article in the Globe and Mail that basically tried to say Canada's role in the Lima Group was well-intentioned, and then the U.S. came by and messed it up. And I kind of want to know at least your take on, since this hasn't really been anything I've seen reported so widely about Stuart Savage's appointment to the OAS, what role do you think Canadian media has in this dynamic and this attitude towards Latin America?
Yeah, I mean, Canadian media is, I mean, first and foremost, coverage of the Americas in, you know, the Globe and Mail, the Star, the CBC is first and foremost fairly non-existent. It's just not there. You see oftentimes decontextualized reporting on, you know, really when things get bad enough that the media pays attention to it. And so you see, for example, you know, some pious reporting and commentary in major Canadian media outlets without any sort of next steps, without any sort of, well, wait a minute, was this a one-off or is this a matter of policy? Is this a pattern that we've seen? So first and foremost, the media coverage is non-existent. Second, when you do see coverage, it tends to be decontextualized, and the kind of next steps, the questions that would open into kind of larger interrogations of Canada's role in the Americas are just left wanting. And so it's up to, you know, independent media. It's up to NGOs like, you know, Mining Watch, like Mining and Justice Solidarity Network, the Caribbean Solidarity Network, groups that are largely people, you know, concerned about the role of Canadian businesses and the Canadian government throughout the world, people in the diaspora of countries that have been affected by the consequences of these actions, and concerned citizens, because, you know, you walk down the street, most folks don't want to know that they've got, you know, blood on their hands that they had nothing to do with putting there.
I think just wrapping up with the political situation in not only Canada, but in Latin America, so drastically different. We talked about, you know, how 1954 Venezuela is different than, you know, 2000s Venezuela versus 2017 versus now. Where do you see Canadian foreign policy, the OAS, and all these countries going forward in the future, especially with this mounting criticism against Canadian mining in the area?
Unfortunately, I'm not very optimistic. And I'm not optimistic for just purely political reasons. If we take Venezuela as an example, there's no politically advantageous reason for a Trudeau government or for any government that should come after to stake out an independent and principled position in a very difficult context in Venezuela. What they do have is they have a very sizable anti-Maduro Venezuelan diaspora in Canada, and they have Canadian businesses that are looking to cash in on, you know, what's to come of the Venezuelan oil industry and the mining industry in Venezuela as well, in the Amazon. Similar things can be said for Haiti. There's no reason for Canada to stake out an independent, principled humanitarian position. It just doesn't add up in terms of the electoral logic locally and trying to get a majority for a government. It doesn't add up financially, because the businesses that are most interested in Latin America are not the kind of businesses that are interested in sharing revenues or allowing local communities to have a say in how a mine operates, if indeed it opens at all. So unfortunately, I'm not terribly optimistic under present circumstances, or, you know, in the foreseeable future, that Canada will, unless pressured, unless significantly pressured from Canadians, will stake out an independent, humanitarian, more democratically informed and just position vis-a-vis the Americas. On the other hand, that said, Canada's role is increasingly, shall we say, it's kind of pushing back towards irrelevance. I mean, I'll put it this way. I'm from the United States originally, and I'm old enough to remember that when traveling in Latin America or elsewhere, you know, as an English-speaking white dude, you put a Canadian flag on your backpack so people don't, you know, yell at you for being a Yankee. That's not the case anymore, right? Canada's reputation is done. It's where it's not done for, it is severely tarnished. And as a result, it doesn't really have the kind of pull that it once had. Furthermore, because of the actions over the last 20 years that the Canadian government has taken on behalf of Canadian mining industries, the ability for Canada to influence policymakers, elites, and decision makers is increasingly circumscribed to those groups of people who study in Canada, who are part of that economic elite, and who are always already going to be on Canada's side anyway. So on the one hand, there's no reason to expect Canada to chart a radically different course. And on the other hand, or on a similar hand, Canada's standing in the region has really diminished. Its image is sullied. And so its ability to play that middle power role it has tried to play historically has really fallen by the wayside.
Was Donald Kingsbury and Rabble's national politics reporter Scott Martin in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Donald and Scott. Switching gears now, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel covers a report that suggests alternatives to youth incarceration in Canada. Evidence shows putting children behind bars leads to overall worse general adult health, higher recidivism rates, and lower life expectancies. Despite this, Canada continues to jail youth by the tens of thousands each year. But a new report from the Sentencing Project presents six effective alternatives to child incarceration. While their findings reflect American statistics, it offers a blueprint for Canada to adopt some alternatives of its own. Those six alternatives are: credible messenger mentoring programs, advocate and mentorship programs, family-focused multidimensional therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, restorative justice interventions, and wraparound programs. In labor news, Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga reports, Canadian truckers continue to face unfair labor practices and wage theft. According to the community organization Justice for Workers, trucking makes up 17% of federally regulated workers, but 85% of claims for unpaid wages. A statement on their website reads, "Wage theft is rampant for truck drivers, yet the gaps in the Canada Labor Code and ineffective enforcement leave all too many truckers without their hard-earned wages and leave employers confident they can steal workers' wages." Kaluge Kasuga sat down with Majinder Singh, a former trucker with JHK Golden Express, who, to this day, says he still owed $10,000. Now, Singh is organizing for better labor conditions for truck drivers. Singh said, quote, "We must show employers that they will have consequences, even if they aren't facing many from the government at this time," end quote. Also this week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's cabinet shuffle was drastic, with 30 out of 38 ministers assigned to new jobs or kicked out of cabinet entirely. Parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg notes, however, that while pundits focus on the effect this shuffle will have on the polls, there are some serious policy challenges that these new ministers will face. Of particular note are the challenges facing Sean Fraser, new Minister for Housing, Infrastructure and Communities, and Pascal Saint-Onge, who is now Minister for Canadian Heritage. Canada's housing crisis continues to worsen across the country, with the cities of Vancouver and Toronto being particularly difficult for Canadians living there to find an affordable place to live. A recent Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives report shows that two people earning minimum wage in either city would not be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment without spending more than 30% of their combined income on housing. Meanwhile, Pascal Saint-Onge and the Ministry for Canadian Heritage will be responsible for navigating Canadian media through an ever-changing landscape. Bill C-18 has led to a dispute between Facebook, Google, and the federal government, with Canadian media companies caught in the middle. And the CBC, a favorite target of Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, is in need of a new funding mandate to sustain it into the future. And finally, a word from a rabble-rouser to watch, Neighbours United.
Hi, I'm Montana Burgess from Neighbours United. What we do is we use compassionate curiosity, non-judgment, and storytelling through deep canvassing, community organizing, and strategic solutions storytelling to shift public opinion towards the climate, energy, and biodiversity solutions that we need for people and the planet. I'm honored to be named a Rabble Rouser to Watch for 2023 and would like to thank Rabble's readers for nominating us. For more information on the work we do, check out my interview on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Montana. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
The Nikkei Garden Farmers Market is pleased to announce its return for the third year in a row, running from June to October. The market will take place on the 2nd and 4th Sundays of each month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Visitors to the market can enjoy a relaxing stroll through the locally grown produce booths, indulge in the delicious locally crafted food, and explore unique artisanal goods made by local makers, while taking in the seasonal beauty of the Japanese garden. To learn more about this event, visit center.nikkeiplace.org.
Radio.